Okay, our final agenda item of the day is a briefing on the coastal and marine spatial planning. It's behind tab one. We welcome Sam Raup, Deputy Assistant Administrator for Regulatory Programs. Welcome, Sam.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here. I always welcome the opportunities to go to the councils. For those of you who don't know me, I am Sam Raup, the Deputy Director of the National Marine Fisheries Service. I am responsible for the six regions of the country, the six regional offices, and also three headquarters offices within NMFS, dealing with both the Magnuson Act, with the Endangered Species Act, and with habitat conservation. I was also one of the principal negotiators for NOAA of the National Ocean Policy, so I've been asked to come talk about the policy, and in particular about coastal marine spatial planning, and thank you again for the invitation. On July 19th of this year, the President signed an executive order adopting a national ocean policy. In it, he outlined the vision for our stewardship of the coast and oceans, and the vision is an America whose stewardship ensures that the oceans, coast, and Great Lakes are healthy and resilient, safe and productive, and understood and treasured so as to promote the well-being, prosperity, and security of present and future generations. The policy itself is composed of four main building blocks. One is the policy document, the vision statement, a series of bulletized points to elaborate on the vision statement, talking about healthy and resilient ecosystems and economies, safe and productive economic development in the oceans, recognizing that the oceans are a major source of economic benefit around the country, and about the importance of understanding and treasuring the oceans for prosperity, well-being, and security. In addition to the policy and its several implementing principles, there is also an intergovernmental structure that has been created to facilitate the policy. I will talk about that further on. There are a number of national priority objectives, nine of them, which I will talk about briefly, and then the bulk of the rest of the policy and the bulk of my discussion will be on the framework for coastal and marine spatial planning. It is coastal, by the way, because it includes the Great Lakes, and I had to go give a similar presentation in Detroit 2 weeks ago. The National Ocean Council is the intergovernmental structure that has been set up. It met, it is a group of 27 departments, cabinet-level entities, and NOAA, which meets and is in order to do a few things, to set priorities for the government in ocean policy, to resolve any conflicts that might arise before it gets to the President, and to serve as a listening function. You'll notice that there is a new organization created, the Governance Coordinating Committee, which allows jurisdictional entities from the states, tribal, and local governments to have input directly into this cabinet-level organization on what the priorities should be for ocean research and management. There is an existing advisory body, the Ocean Research and Resources Advisory Panel, which has existed for years, but which we thought it needed to expand its membership to be better representative of the full range of stakeholders. Fishing interests are not very well represented, nor are any others. It is dominated by the research branch, which is not a bad thing, but if it is going to serve as a true public stakeholder input advisory committee, which is its design, it needs to have better stakeholder representation. There is a steering committee, and then there are other management committees. There is the Ocean Resources Management Committee, subcommittee, and then there's the science subcommittee. These are derivatives of two existing committees that exist now. They've been reconstituted. The first one is designed to work on conflict resolution and resource policy. The other one is a science-based organization. We, in our own internal evaluations about how these structures worked in the prior administration, We thought that the research group, which is now the Ocean Science and Technology Committee, had worked fairly well to set broad research objectives and policy and to advocate for funding to fund those policies. But the management committee had not worked as well, largely because there was not an overarching directive policy. There was not a goal for the management committee to work towards. So the policy itself does solve that problem, and a lot of what we'll talk about in the future, in the rest of the discussion, will be managed by that committee. The National Ocean Council just met last week, and so it formally constituted itself, and it will be carrying out many of its duties. Some of the timelines in the ocean policy had called for a quicker meeting of that council, but because it was a secretarial level group, they finally met. There is permanent staff, which did not exist before and is something that is needed in order to make sure that this policy has a life after its signature. In addition to the policy statement itself and the structure, there are nine priority objectives for how we're going to do business. One of them is very familiar to this council because it is the presentation you just had, is ecosystem-based management. Throughout the policy, it discusses the importance of ecosystem-based management, about looking beyond single species or single sector management and looking broadly at all the impacts on the ocean. And that is a fundamental basis on which the policy is built. NOAA believes that it has the goal of carrying out ecosystem-based management where we can. Oftentimes we don't have the tools or we're not where we want to be on that, but it is something that we are striving to do, and we did get the commitment for other agencies to do this as well. Coastal marine spatial planning, which we'll talk about. Informed decisions and improved understanding, that's where you get the better science, better education of the public. Coordinate and support doesn't sound all that exciting, but that is where we deal with the issue of the multitude of authorizing entities, the multitude of jurisdictional entities governing whatever you're going to do in the ocean, and how those jurisdictions do not always complement one another, but sometimes they act at cross purposes. And so the policy sets up this committee, this priority objective, to try to streamline those functions, to try to make them work more in tandem, and to look at gaps. Where do we have legislative needs, or where do we have conflicting legislative priorities? This committee is going to be the one that is set up and is going to look at those questions. The policy itself at the moment does not envision any legislative follow-through. It does not need legislation to implement it. But through this committee, there may at some point be a legislative recommendation out of this. There are also five areas of special emphasis. The first one is climate adaptation and ocean acidification, not whether or not these environmental changes are occurring, but how we can adapt to them, how we deal with the fact that fishing populations may be moving to follow temperature gradients, or the potential effect of ocean acidification on, say, shellfish. How does not only the fisheries deal with it, but how do the communities deal with this? Regional ecosystem protection and restoration is important. These are large areas. We do a fairly good job around the country on small-scale restoration projects, on isolated rivers, on harbors. This is an effort to use the resources of the federal government to look much more broadly, to consider the Chesapeake Bay, to consider the Mississippi Delta, the San Francisco Bay, areas where the needs are so broad that it defies that local jurisdictions have a difficulty dealing with it, but the federal government, by looking holistically, can take a better approach to it. The third one is water quality sustainable practices on land. This reflects the fact that whatever we do upstream can have a profound effect in the ocean, and to some extent vice versa. There needs to be a recognition that on development on land, actions on land, are part of our ocean policy. If we allow environmental degradation and pollution on land, we are by default making statements to what the health of our oceans are going to be. And so this one is not, while this one is not a, NOAA is not a significant jurisdictional entity in this one, EPA and USDA, or the Agriculture Department, are more of a significant player. We clearly have an interest in this area. The Arctic is important to us as sea level, as ice recedes and potential for development in the Arctic opens up, dealing with not only the species up there, but the sensitive habitats up there is important. And the last one is the need to improve our observing systems, both the infrastructure, the mapping capability, and all the ways in which we observe the marine resources. This lines up well with the NOAA's new strategic plan. NOAA has been developing a strategic plan, and many of the negotiators for the ocean policy were also negotiators for NOAA's strategic plan. And so we've got a lot of cross-linkages between the two efforts, which is no surprise. All right, I'm going to spend the rest of the discussion on coastal marine spatial planning. The need for coastal marine spatial planning, it has always been a priority for Dr. Lubchenco, the head of NOAA. The need is apparent as the oceans become more crowded. We can no longer expect that if the fishermen go out to fish that they will be the only ones on the ocean. There are other people demanding that space, whether it is aquaculture or energy development or navigation or other things out on the ocean. And there is a need for to look at what we do in the ocean in a holistic manner, as opposed to on a sector-by-sector basis. We believe we try to do a very good job about considering all the cumulative impacts of what we do on the ocean, but it is true that when we're making our fishery decisions, we're not perhaps considering the energy development impacts of that, the navigational impacts of that, and vice versa. Those jurisdictions that regulate energy or that regulate navigation, transportation, or other uses of the ocean, they may not be fully considering the fishing impacts of what they're going to do. And so there is a need for us to look forward without a particular project on the table to be able to plan as to where we can get synergies, where it makes sense to do things and where it makes sense to preserve things. It's very difficult to deal with settled, either permanent applicants or settled activities, and to say after the fact that wasn't a good idea. We need to think about these ahead of time. The key elements of the coastal marine spatial planning is the first one is that it is not a mechanism to create large marine protected areas. There is, if you read the document, it talks about the need to ensure the economic development of the oceans, that it happens in a sound manner, that it continues. It reflects the importance of fishing and other things that go on the ocean to our coastal economies. So there's also a recognition that the healthy economies require the healthy ecosystem to continue to provide those services. And so there is a need to engage in what the council and things like the council does already. Things like looking at essential fish habitat, what may be able to go on or not, or as what Paul was talking about, or the last presentation, the productivity analysis. You know, where are we getting the most productivity out of the ocean for fishermen? There's a recognition that whatever planning that we do must be open to all the stakeholders. It can't be a process that is co-opted by any individual interest groups, whether it be the environmental community, coastal zone managers community, the fishing community, the energy community. All of these important players must be at the table, must be able to discuss this openly or the process will not work, and they must feel that it is a fair and open and transparent process. Science is important. We take this as for granted at NOAA. Everything we do, we try to do based on science. I will talk about the particular challenges of science in marine spatial planning in a moment. And there needs to be a recognition that while this is a national policy, and because it is a national policy, by its very nature, a top-down direction, that each region of the country is different. The particular players and the particular challenges in each region of the country are vastly different, and their approaches to marine spatial planning may be different. We've never done this in the United States at this level. And if you look around the world, there are very few other countries that are engaging in anything as ambitious as this. And there are different models, and they each have their advantages and their disadvantages. There are states, particularly in the Northeast, which are beginning to do these kind of things and are actually already engaged in this process. They have important lessons to teach us, but it may be that what works in New England may not work in Alaska or in the Gulf of Mexico. And so the policy is intensely vague on some details about how the process should be set up, what the Marine Spatial Plan should look like, how decisions should be made. And that is a recognition that a lot of these decisions need to be made by the regional representatives themselves, reflecting the unique characters of that region. All right, how is this going to work? We divided the country into 9 regions based on the work that NOAA largely had done on defining large marine ecosystems, areas of the country where it makes some sense to draw lines on the map for biological reasons or environmental reasons. They also do correspond with a number of jurisdictional areas already. And in part, the council process was designed based on associations, assemblages. So this comes as no surprise that there is a nice overlap between the council jurisdiction, our large marine ecosystems, but there's also a geopolitical reality to this in that the states are clearly important players. The federal government deals mainly in the EEZ, 3 or in some cases 9 miles off the coast. Within that, the states are major players. Even in the EEZ, the states are major players. You cannot engage in a process, a rational process of any type of coastal marine spatial planning without having the states at the table. And so recognizing the state boundaries are important. It's an important process. The geographic scope is the mean high water level to the extent of the EEZ. If the regional planning bodies agree, they can go further inland into bays and estuaries or other places, but it is not required. If the states do not join, the president has indicated this is a process the federal government will reluctantly undertake on its own, but we very much would rather have the states participate as a co-equal partner in this process. The federal agencies will sign a development agreement, which is an agreement to work cooperatively in the formation of a regional planning body, and they will outline how within the area these are going to go forward. I mentioned the science needs. It is very difficult at times to make sure that all of the relevant data sets are coherent and that they can talk to one another and to have a decision-making tool that represents all of the uses, to have a useful map, something that the decision-makers can use. There is a large national process to try to integrate the data so that one region can talk to another, and within each region there will be a process to integrate the data. This is not a new problem, as many of the scientists here, I'm sure, will tell you, but it is something that we are trying to attack from the marine spatial planning context. The one thing I would caution, in terms of resources, this is a resource-intensive process, and I will talk in a minute about the budget. Many of the people I talk to have great ideas and innovative ideas about new mapping techniques, new decision-making tools, and all that is very important, but we must not lose sight of the fact that there also resources needs to be invested in the plan itself, in the decision makers, in the plan writers, and in the meeting space to deal with that. We must not stop at the map or stop at the tool. We have to keep going until we can get the plan and actually implement and use that tool. All right, so NOAA's role in implementation. We bring to the table, as does the councils, legal authority over fishing. We also were involved in coastal zone management and sanctuaries, other aspects of NOAA, other agencies bring their jurisdictions to the table. All the federal agencies are bringing their jurisdiction to the table. We also bring our scientific expertise to the table. NOAA intends to participate on all nine of these regional planning bodies. And I should say that each of those regions that I outlined before, in six of them, there are pre-existing regional governance organizations, mainly groups where the states have gotten together and they agreed to work on joint priorities. In the Northeast, it's NROC. In the three other ones, Alaska, the Caribbean, and the Western Pacific, there's not a regional governance organization existing so far. The policy does not anticipate that those regional governance organizations, or does not require those regional governance organizations to be the regional planning body. And in fact, there's some reasons why they may not be. First of all, the federal government is not a party. The federal agencies are not a party to all of those organizations. All of those organizations do not have the transparency requirement that we want to see. Some of those organizations, particularly like the West Coast Governors Agreement, is an agreement among existing governors, some of them who didn't run for reelection. And so there needs to be some permanence to that organization. Nevertheless, the policy does encourage those regional governance organizations to work on the regional planning body, to become the regional planning body. And so where they exist, we've been encouraging and trying to structure, rather than to create a new planning body out of whole cloth, trying to determine whether or not those governance organizations can or would or can be adopted into that planning body. Ultimately, the National Ocean Council will bless the planning body, but it is going to be a ground-up organization. As I think Paul mentioned to this council earlier, he's been to NROC. They've agreed to include the council in their deliberations. They've agreed to support the council as sitting on the regional planning body. It remains to be seen, I think, how that whole structure is going to work with NROC, but that's a very good step. As I mentioned, this is a resource-intensive process. The FY11 budget, which has not been approved yet by Congress, includes $6.7 million to support coastal marine spatial planning, largely going to NOAA structures for decision-making tools, data integration, and mapping, but also $20 million in grants to the regional ocean partnerships to both help them with the data needs, but also to get at this issue, which I indicated, of the human factor, the staffing needed to do this, the meeting space needed to do this. And so there is money out there. There has been a federal funding opportunity that's been identified. I believe it expires in December for these regional ocean partnerships to apply for grants. We can't distribute any money until Congress appropriates it, if Congress appropriates it. And then within NOAA, we are developing a coastal marine spatial planning program, which is going to consist of four staff members to try to facilitate all the various NOAA efforts on this. There are four dedicated full-time staff members, but each regional office, each NOAA regional team is allocating a significant amount of resources. And Betsy Nicholson from the Northeast regional team was going to be here today, but she couldn't make it at the last minute. But NOAA is trying to support this effort across the board. Within NOAA, there is a CMSP website, if you are interested, cmsp.noaa.gov, which from the NOAA perspective will not only talk about CMSP, but about how we're implementing the ocean policy. And I wanted to spend a moment before I open this up for questions to talk about the role of fishery management councils. They have a lot to bring to the table in this process. First of all, their experience. Fishing is one of the resources that are potentially at issue in coastal marine spatial planning. Obviously, the knowledge and expertise about fishing resides in this council and in the council process, and that needs to be taken into account, not only from the scientific perspective, but from the economic perspective, from the community perspective. The council does provide one forum for constituent input into the process. Not the only forum, but one forum to make sure that the various stakeholders, that are interested in fishing policy can talk to the regional planning bodies. And finally, they have management responsibilities that they bring to the table. We, throughout the process of developing the plan, we heard from the councils that they wanted to be at the table for the regional planning bodies. And in fact, I believe that they need to be at the table. It is very difficult if somebody is going to be planning fishing policy and not have the councils there. It is difficult on the federal government. I'm not sure how the federal government would implement a situation if the plan came out and had a direction for fishing policy that was inconsistent with the goals of the council. And if the council took action inconsistent with the plan, I'm not sure how we would deal with that. I think the easiest way to avoid that is to make sure that the council is at the table and that the council is one of the signatories to the plan. If that happens, then I don't see that there is any disconnect between the how the National Fisheries Service would implement the plan and the goals of the council. The good news is, as I think Paul reported earlier, the NROC has agreed that the council should be part of the regional planning body. In the policy itself, it left open the question of whether the council should be part of the planning bodies. They were not originally. The planning bodies were limited to state and tribal jurisdictional entities. I think it is a good sign that the council will be on the planning body that comes out of the Northeast, which I would imagine. And I know that other councils like the Mid-Atlantic and the others that I've talked to are similarly interested, and we would encourage that. The best way to be on those planning bodies is to be active like this council has been and trying to get on it as they are formed. Separate and apart from the council, the policy discusses frequently the importance of fishing as a part of the economy, not just commercial fishing but recreational fishing. We heard loudly through the from the draft policy that we needed to make a better distinction and recognize the value of recreational fishing itself, which we did. And so the policy does now talk more fully about the importance not just of commercial fishing but also recreational fishing. And fishermen or stakeholders in the fishing policy have two avenues now, we believe, in being a part of the planning process. One is directly through the council. The regional planning body nationally, if the council is not at the table, they have to have a formal consultation mechanism with the council. The second one is direct. We do believe that the process needs to be transparent. There needs to be a mechanism for stakeholder involvement. And so there should be a way for stakeholders to directly interact with the regional planning body, not just through the council, although the council can be an important forum. The last thing I want to emphasize is that this is not intended to be a new layer of bureaucracy or regulation. This is intended to be forward-looking, a plan that applies ahead of time, not something that if we issue a fishery management plan, we'll have to go back and seek permission from any other council or any other entity. It is one of the inputs into our planning process as opposed to a check at the back end. It is not intended to stop ongoing activities that are going on in the ocean. Explicitly in the policy, it talks about the fact that ongoing activities are not intended to stop while we develop these plans, although it is intended to guide how we develop those in the future or how we might move or change them in the future, much like the council considers how fishing should be engaged in the future. The last thing I wanted to point out, in addition to the NOAA-centric website, which I pointed out earlier, there is a White House website which talks about the policy, and as the National Ocean Council begins to be formed and move out, this website will be where the administration puts its goals and objectives. You can find the policy there. You can find updates there as to what's going on. It's whitehouse.gov/oceans. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Sam. Questions for Sam. Sally.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a few questions. First, thank you very much for sticking around after dark. So can you clarify what is the difference between NROC and the regional planning body, or are they potentially one and the same?
They are potentially one and the same. At the moment, the regional planning body in the Northeast does not exist. None of them do. They will only officially exist when the National Ocean Council blesses them. So at the moment, NROC and the other regional ocean governance structures around the country are trying to determine how that regional planning body is going to be structured. So I think that they've been discussing that. They have some ideas of that. I mean, in my view, if all the stakeholders in the region, particularly the states, can agree on the structure for the regional planning body, I don't think the federal government is going to say anything different. We do not want to create a different body. We would like NROC or something like it to be the regional planning body. But it doesn't exist yet.
Okay, thank you. Do you see any potential role for the Gulf of Maine Council in this?
I think I'm not sure how that would interact with NROC. It would be a more regional council than NROC. So it could be a subset. It could feed into that. Part of the reason that this is a ground-up approach and that there is some vagueness in the process is, particularly in the Northeast, there are a number of existing marine spatial planning activities that are going on already. And the federal government did not want to curtail those or stop those or they're doing good work right now, and we didn't want to overturn that. So one of the challenges for whatever the regional planning body in the Northeast is going to be is to try to figure out how those existing organizations can feed into the process. I don't know what the answer will be, but that is something that the Northeast is, as an entity will have to deal with.
So along those lines, is there potential for additional full-fledged partners in addition to, as you said, the council wasn't originally designed to be sitting at the table. Are there other partners that might be at the table? For example, Canada. For example, Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, recognizing that the states are heavily engaged nonetheless. Those are just two examples that I'm thinking of today.
So I do think entities with jurisdictional hooks, like the council, like Canada, like the ASMSC, may well have a good argument to be at the table. I think the table should be quite large. I think everybody should be at the table. The question is who is the actual signatories on the plan. And the policy discusses the need that those be the jurisdictional entities. In my view, if the region gets together and wants to include further jurisdictional entities, I do not believe the federal government will say no to that. There is a concern on other from the parts of other agencies, or there was through the process of this getting out of hand. NOAA believed that this should be an open-ended process, that more people should be at the table. But the policy did come out and limit it to jurisdictional entities. It does talk about international and the fact that it would be very good if what we do here can broach the border both with Canada in the Northeast and the Northwest, or Mexico in the South. But because this was a domestic U.S. policy, and we did not want to impose on Canada, but if they so choose to participate, we would be happy to have them. That's the same message I gave to them in the Great Lakes. And certainly, I would think with ASMFC, if they wanted to participate as well, if that's how the states chose to participate in state waters for state fishing interest, then they would have a good argument.
One more question. I think you mentioned that fishing interests would have the opportunity to engage directly with the regional planning body in addition to through the seat that the council will hold. Do you have an idea about how that might happen, or is that also something that's going to be left to each region to determine?
So the public participation is left to each region to determine in the regional planning bodies, and it could happen differently. But that is a criteria for national approval. The administration will not approve a regional planning body unless there is open and transparent decision-making and stakeholder input. How that happens, it can happen in a number of different ways. And the federal government, I don't see at the outset putting down restrictions on what should or shouldn't occur. But we do want to make sure that all stakeholders have the ability to participate in the process.
And just one more comment. You mentioned that this is a resource-intensive process, and then in my thought on that was it really is just as much, in my mind, a resource optimization process, so that all of the potentially conflicting interests on the water can figure out better how to coexist. So, you know, I'm thinking about that in the context of really tight budget years coming up for I don't know how many years to come, and how various state and federal requirements for energy, transportation, fishing, obviously, are going to get their jobs done that they have to get done. But to get it done in a way that reduces conflict, and this is a way to do that. So that was just something that came to mind as you were saying that it's resource intensive, and I understand you to mean that it's going to cost some money to get it done. And I'm talking about resource optimization in terms of natural resources and resources used. So I'm talking about two different things, but they're related to the same issue, which is that there's not necessarily going to be as much money as we might like to have to get the job done. So thanks again.
Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Sam. Just sort of along the line of Sally's last question, is there some recognition in the establishment of the regional planning bodies that all of the existing organizations and authorities are doing a poor job or have not been able to coordinate their efforts well enough?
There is a recognition that nationally we can do better at coordinating the issues with the Gulf of Mexico oil spill is cited as a specific example of issues where we could have done better to coordinate, particularly from NOAA's perspective. Had NOAA been more involved in that process, some of the ultimate issues with siting might have been avoided. So there is a recognition that the federal agencies, if they look beyond their narrow strictures of their jurisdiction, can work together better and plan better. But there's also a recognition that no matter how well we're doing now, the problems that we see now are just going to increase as the oceans become more crowded, and we need to think about how we better deal with this now. Even if the current structures are meeting the needs, they unlikely will continue to do so as greater demands are placed on both the ecosystem and the ocean space.
And the $20 million of grants, is there any part of those that have either incentives or requirements doing a better job at coordinating? In other words, are these grants just being handed out to each regional body on some basis of the amount of territory they have, or are there things that they have to do to get those that are based on the function of the regional planning board? And just one quick follow up: is that new funding, or is that something that got shuffled around from somewhere else within the NOAA budget?
Well, it's new funding within the NOAA budget. Whether or not there were program offsets, I couldn't begin to tell you. It is a competitive grant program, so there is not a set amount of money that is allocated for any region or any individual. In order to get that money, you have to have some support from the state, and you have to lay out the criteria for how you're going to use that money effectively. That is spelled out, I don't have it with me, but in the federal funding opportunity, which was issued in the Federal Register about a month and a half ago or so, the criteria. But it is somewhat open-ended in terms of can you use the money effectively? How can you do it? But it is competitive, so you'll have to demonstrate that you're going to do a better job than the other people.
Moving down the line, got Jim Fair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for coming today, Sam, and thanks for your presentation. You said a lot of things that made me feel a lot better about this whole process. I have to say that a lot of us were starting to get into a kind of a defensive mode because, quite frankly, the original draft that we saw was very light on fisheries, and some of the early meetings were even worse. And I just wanted to get your take on that. Has that situation improved at your level?
This is a national policy, and fisheries are but one of the economic drivers there. And the initial draft of the policy did not articulate well, or did not separately highlight fisheries as important. It didn't highlight any in particular use of the ocean as important. We made significant efforts to improve that because of the loud and vocal comments that we received about that, which was good from my perspective. I thought that was a welcome change. I do think that it is important that this organization and fishing interests across the country stay involved in this process. If you are involved, if you're at the table, then I think fishing interests can and the importance of fishing to the economy will be adequately represented. If you are not involved and are not at the table, it will still go on, and we may not like the results. The National Marine Fisheries Service is trying very hard to maintain an active presence in this process because fishing is important to us. But we cannot substitute for the stakeholders themselves. And so I do think there has been some initial reluctance on the part, at least nationally, to consider the fishing organizations as players. I think regionally this hasn't been the case. I think that where the councils have gone to these regional planning bodies, like you went to NROC, Chairman Robbins went to MARCO, I think there has been acceptance. I heard the same thing on the West Coast with the West Coast governors. In Alaska, the Alaska Council may well be forming the regional planning bodies. So I think in the regions themselves, dealing with these regional planning bodies, I haven't seen that same resistance that I sort of saw at the national level, and that's good. And my view is, since this is a ground-up policy, you know, that the federal government will not gainsay the important role that fishing interests have. You know, if you can get the support of the regions to be a player, if you are active in this, I think that fishing interests will be well represented.
Paul Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A lot of folks, Sam, view this as a grand experiment to coordinate, you know, 20, 30 bodies in one region, a coordinating thing. I look at it more because I go to the table, or the council should go to the table, to think that whatever comes out of this plan, there's a process to approve it. And we shouldn't be naive that this is just an experiment to coordinate. There will be a plan. That plan will be approved. And whatever it is in that plan, we should go forward to say it's going to be implemented. So that's why it's very important to consider this as a very important effort.
I agree completely, and that's why I think the council absolutely needs to be there, because I'm not sure how we would implement it if it is inconsistent with council policies. But if the councils are there and sign on, and it has to be a unanimous plan. You can't get outvoted. If the council are there and a signatory, then everybody's going forth together, and I think, you know, you're implementing it because that's what the council intends to do. And then I can see how this will work.
Doug Grubb.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm following up on Rip's comment. concerning the budget requests, these budget requests you have here are NOAA budget requests for $20 million and the $6.7 million?
They're the president's budget. They're in the president's budget.
Okay, so they're president's budget for the entire process. Will they be coming through NOAA then, or?
If Congress appropriates the money as requested, it'll come through NOAA to distribute. And NOAA has already issued a Federal Register notice seeking applicants in the event that Congress would appropriate the money.
Are there any other resources that are being brought to the table by the other agencies that are part of the National Ocean Council?
So first let me back up. There's a number of resources that have already gone into these regional governance organizations. A lot of them already get federal funds to help with this. So there's more than just the Coastal Marine Spatial Planning part. There is that. A lot of the decision-making tools and science integration are priorities regardless of the Coastal Marine Spatial Planning. And a lot of them are funded by federal funds. So in some sense, this is the pot of money that's identified for Coastal Marine Spatial Planning. As a result of the policy, I am aware that DOI is working on some funds to help with regional organization support, but I don't think it's in the president's budget yet. I think they're working on that. So my view is, with all these fundings, we have to recognize the federal budget process gets set well in advance. Right now, internally, I'm working on the 2013 budget. It is very difficult for us, even though the president did this policy in 2010, it's difficult for us in 2010 to actually allocate funds. I would expect as we go forward in time and those budgets get more robust, that they will more accurately reflect the president's policies. But right now, this is what we've got in there. And there may be opportunities for other agencies, but I don't think there is. They're not as targeted as this for Coastal Marine Spatial Planning.
Mary Beth? Dave Gatel.
Well, I had a lot of questions, but it's late. I'm just going to ask one. This was set up by executive order. And does Congress have any oversight at all of this other than to appropriate money or not? Is that the only leverage they have if they don't like a decision, as an example?
Congress has a lot of authority. Congress gives us the rules in which we operate under. Within that, they give us the discretion. So we're operating within the discretionary bounds that Congress gives us. If Congress decides they don't like this, Congress could stop it, either through the budgetary process or not. At this point, I don't know that Congress is going to do that, but they certainly have the authority. They have the authority to dictate how the president executes the laws, and this would be one way. So, yes, they have the authority if they don't like it. And it's not just budgetary authority.
Okay. So, again, I'm trying to look at all the various people participating in this. I think it's on the second page, the Ocean Resource Management Interagency Policy Committee. Is that basically the equivalent of the old CMOR, the Subcommittee on Integrated? Okay.
Yes.
And so, again, there's some idea that the idea behind this is to get all these disparate agencies to work together and come up with solutions for the common good. That's, I hope, where we're going.
That's correct. As the old CMOR process, which was the Subcommittee on Integrated Management of Ocean Resources. I'm impressed with myself. This is the successor to that. It did not operate very effectively because it didn't have a direction. It was the agencies would meet, and if issues come up, they would deal with them after the fact. This group is essentially the same group, but now it has permanent staff, so there will be a tracking of issues, and it has direction. It's intended to carry out this policy. So it has a mission now, and we believe it will be more successful.
So I'm just having, I had probably because it's late. I've just got a little bit of a hard time following. If something's done at, say, this NROC in the Northeast, will that then go to Seymour for final approval or implementation? Or I'm just trying to understand kind of like the chain of command.
I think if NROC became the regional planning body and issued a plan, it would go directly to the National Ocean Council for approval. I do not believe it would go to Seymour in terms of plan approval. If there was a dispute under the plan, or if two agencies couldn't agree either in crafting the plan or in the execution of the plan, it would go to Seymour first before it went to the larger body. And they would try to resolve it. Everything is done by a consensus until it gets to the president, because the president can dictate. But before that, it's all by consensus if we can resolve it.
Okay, so if it goes to the National Ocean Council and they agree to implement it, then do they send it back to one of these other groups of that's made up of all the agencies to make it happen, or?
It would go back to the agencies would be on NROC, right? And the agencies are on the regional planning body, so it would go back to the agencies. The agencies would individually sign it. So for the Commerce Department, NIMS would sign. If the councils are on there, they would sign, and so they would be implementing it based on their signature that said that they could and want to implement it.
Okay, I think I'm starting to understand now. I went down and testified in front of Seymour one time, and I was impressed that we had that many agencies that, you know, you needed a room bigger than this just to get the people around the table and then all the issues surrounding it. And I just was never quite sure how you could ever really make anything happen when you had that many agencies with that many disparate views on how you do something.
Yeah, and I think that's where the permanent staff will help. It did not have staff at that time, and the permanent staff will help, much like the staff here, clarify the issues and bring them to a more manageable decision point.
Rick Robbins.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Sam, thanks for that presentation, and thanks for continuing to provide both of our councils with advice on this matter. I hear you telling us to continue to work regionally on this, and it sounds like this council has had success recently in its interaction with NROC. Our council has had a number of successful engagements now with Marco, and we're just finalizing formalizing our request for representation on their management board and on their working groups with staff representation. If we have successes at the regional level, what advice would you have for us as councils? How can the councils work together to try to project that type of model up at the national level? In other words, if we put together a viable model within the region, how can we ensure that the councils are integrated rather than simply left in a consultative role that's basically right now undefined in the policy?
I think we had a similar discussion at the Mid-Atlantic, but what I envision happening, the policy talks about the councils, and as I said, it highlights the importance of the councils. No other similar group is highlighted like the councils are. It says that the councils are not initially part of the regional planning bodies, but it creates a mechanism where it says that they have to be consulted, and it leaves open the possibility of revisiting that initial determination from above. In my view, if it is left as a determination from above, none of us will be particularly satisfied with the result. And so what I've encouraged and what the councils have done is gone out and reached out to these regional governance structures like NROC and Marco to get their support. I think that once some of this happens, like the Northeast, like Marco, like maybe the West Coast governors, and we've seen success in general up and down the seaboard, I think it might be very good for the council chairs to accumulate that experiences and to make a formal request of the NOC or make the case to the NOC that they should be formally recognized. It would help if that comes along with the endorsements of these regional structures. So I do think that the best way to get the councils at the table is by demonstrating success and partnerships.
Mr. Libby.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Sam. It's kind of a question along the same lines. You said NOAA, or the Fisheries Service, is fighting really hard to be part of this, and it's a recurring theme, but I'm just curious why something that seems obvious that wouldn't have to fight to be part of it has to fight to be part of it. Are there any agencies that don't have to fight to be part of it, like transportation, defense, wind, you know, energy like that, or does everybody have to take an equal swing at it? Thank you.
I didn't mean to imply that we think we'll be left out by some other third party. Where we would be left out is if we did not commit the time and resources to participate. We think it's very important to participate, and so we are allocating those resources to get it done. A lot of the regional planning, there are other interests involved. Interior is a big player with the energy, transportation with navigation, the military, Department of Defense. We need to make sure that we stay at the table and ensure that this continues to be a priority for us. We need to go to all the meetings. Lack of participation is the surest way that things will go awry. And so we want to make sure that we are there, that much like the councils are trying to be there, we want to be there internally to make sure that everybody knows that fishing is an important interest, an important issue, and that the interests are well represented. But I don't think there's anybody trying to keep us out other than we get occasionally distracted by other things that are going on, some of which are going on here in New England.
Okay. It's a process that we're getting into but might not have been there at the start. Is that what you're saying?
I certainly think for the councils. From the Fisheries Service, we've been there the whole time. I mean, I was one of the ones negotiating this process. I've been arguing that we should be at the table. We have not ignored this process, but we need to continue to make sure that we're there and we're going to all the meetings. But the councils, we've been struggling to make sure that they to have them well represented.
Thank you.
Thank you. I did have a whole list of questions, but I think people have really covered them well, so that's good. Sam, you do make a good point that those who show up kind of rule the day, and that's particularly important. And when you look at your slide 3, it outlines the different parties, and you do think of NOAA as being the lead ocean agency, and I wonder where in this diagram NOAA is represented.
Yeah, all right. So NOAA is the National Ocean Council. That is made up of the Secretary of Cabinet levels, the Secretary of Commerce, Defense, Interior, and the head of NOAA. We are the only non-secretarial member or non-member of the White House. There's a bunch of White House agencies there. But we have a seat at the National Ocean Council. We are on the steering committee. I think that we have the chairs of the two subgroups down there, the two interagency policy committees, are being worked out. I believe that NOAA will be the chair of at least one, if not both, or a co-chair of one or not both of them. So we are on all those committees, not the governance coordinating committee or the ocean research advisory panel, because those are advisory committees. But every other committee we are on as a named party. And we're the only sort of sub-line office to be there for the National Ocean Council.
Well, it's good to hear that, because it seemed initially that it was quite a question about whether NOAA would be at the table at this high level or not. So I am glad to hear that we are, you are.
Okay. Really, Gene?
Yeah, I hesitate to ask a fellow NOAA employee this, but I think it's important for the council to try to understand this, because I'm having somewhat of a problem with understanding this concept. A couple of times, Sam, you mentioned how if a plan is developed that is inconsistent with council policies, you're not sure what's going to happen at that point or how we resolve that situation. It really goes beyond policies. I think we're one of the few agencies or the resource represents something that where we have mandates, legal mandates to fulfill. So, you know, it's not like we have discretion to avoid those legal mandates. And I don't know if people have thought that all the way through or not, in that we can't abdicate our legal mandates, which is a much stronger term than policies or the authority that we have to exercise our discretion to protect these resources. So is that, are you still thinking about how that is worked out, or is that just going to have to be negotiated and actually give the council even more power or authority at these groups that are developing these policies?
So the legal mandates are given to us by Congress. The president didn't have the authority to change them. We don't have the authority to change them. This plan can't change them. So the plan cannot be or should not be inconsistent with that. When the Department of Commerce signs the plan, we will have to determine that it is consistent with all of our legal mandates, or we will not sign it and the plan will not exist. If that were all we were doing, there could be an argument that the council didn't need to be involved in terms of legal mandates. But the council acts, just like NIMS acts, within the boundaries. Those legal mandates are often quite broad as to what we want to do. There is a huge area of policy considerations within those legal mandates. And that is where the council has the discretion to recommend policies and other kinds of things to fulfill those legal, how best to fulfill those mandates. I think in either instance, we don't want the plan to be incompatible with either the policies choices or the legal mandate choices. But I think the legal mandate choices, that would resolve itself. I think that the plan, there's nothing we could do that could be inconsistent with legal mandates. We would just not approve the plan in that instance.
Okay, well, thanks, Sam. Thanks for waiting it out with us. To the council members, remind you, we'll reconvene tomorrow at 8:30 and take up the enforcement agenda item before we move into scallops. So we'll see you tomorrow.